That line, Syrians go to the polls to elect a new president for the next 7 years. Bashar al-Assad is widely expected to win a fourth seven-year term. Iran's President Hassan Rouhani reiterates that the United States must take the first step to fulfill its commitments under the 2015 nuclear deal. And India crosses the grim milestone of 27 million coronavirus cases as the country registers more than 208,000 new infections in 24 hours. Hello and welcome, everybody. It's our top story for this half hour. Syrians are heading to the polls as voting began across Syria for a presidential election. More than 12,000 polling centers are receiving voters. The Interior Ministry says 18 million Syrians are eligible to vote. Syrian expatriates and refugees cast an early ballot last week in Syria's embassies throughout the world. Incumbent Bashar al-Assad, Abdullah Salam Abdullah, a former state minister, and Mahmoud Marei, an opposition figure, are the three candidates running for president. The U.S., the EU, and Britain have already denounced the election, which is expected to see Assad winning for the fourth term. Damascus, however, says the vote is a sovereign Syrian affair and that only Syrians have the final word in the matter. Hezbollah Secretary General Sayed Hassan Nasrallah says any aggression against Jerusalem al-Quds or its holy sites would mean regional war. Nayan Saleh reports from Beirut.
Hezbollah Secretary General Sayed Hassan Nasrallah gave a televised speech to commemorate the 21st anniversary of the liberation of South Lebanon from the Israeli occupation. May 25, 2000 represents, as Sayed Nasrallah noted, the beginning of an era of victories for the resistance in the region. The most significant stance in this year's speech was a warning to the Israelis to keep their hands off Al-Quds and Muslim and Christian holy sites in Palestine.
The resistance in Gaza created a balance where they said any assault on Al-Aqsa Mosque and Al-Quds will lead to a military confrontation. The new equation that we need to reach is that if they touch Al-Quds, then there will be a regional war. This means all the resistance movements in the region cannot stand idly by if the holy city and the sanctities are under genuine threat. This is a genuine promise that the people of the resistance in the entire region will not forsake the holy city or the Muslim and Christian holy sites to be destroyed.
The leader of the resistance in Lebanon gave a detailed explanation of why the latest confrontation was exceptional and why its results yielded a victory for the Palestinians and a defeat for the Israelis. Experts believe the many victories for the resistance in Palestine are part of the era of triumph, which began in May of 2000.
All the past wars and victories from 2000 to 2006 in Lebanon to 2008 in Gaza until the last battle were all evidence of the accumulation of achievements for victory of the resistance. Today in Gaza in 2021, we saw the peak of the accumulated victories and the failure which is lived by the Israelis. The resistance was able to unite all the Palestinian people, and that victory was an extension of the victories in Lebanon. Now the Palestinian resistance is at the heart of the resistance front in the region, enforcing new realities.
The Lebanese celebrate May 25th as a national holiday, though the last Israeli soldier left South Lebanon on May 25th, 2000, signaling an end to over 18 years of invasions and occupation of Lebanon. The Lebanese official stance considers the Shabah Farms and Kfar Shuba Hills as Lebanese territory that should be liberated.
Celebration of Liberation Day this year in Lebanon has become intertwined with the victory in Palestine, while Lebanese recall that years of sacrifice and resistance against Israeli occupation led to liberty. They believe it is their duty to motivate the Palestinians to continue on that same path until they reach complete freedom. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
The Iranian president says it is the United States that should take the first step when it comes to fulfilling commitments under the 2015 nuclear deal. Hassan Rouhani praised Iranian negotiators in Vienna, saying they made good headway with the talks with their other parties. He said the negotiators have reached agreement on key issues, adding the talks are aimed at reviving the nuclear deal. President Rouhani said issues such as mechanisms for Washington to return to its obligations are being discussed. He said Iran has the upper hand in the negotiations, unlike a few years ago when the opposite was true. India's total coronavirus cases have crossed the 27 million mark following the country's announcement of more than 208,000 new infections in 24 hours. India's health ministry also reported over 4,000 deaths in the same period. The figure pushed the country's total fatalities to more than 311,000. India recorded the world's highest number of new coronavirus cases in the past 7 days. The spike is due to the spread of an aggressive new wave of the virus in the South Asian country in the past weeks. The World Health Organization says the Indian coronavirus variant has now been detected in more than 53 territories in the world. Iran's election watchdog has approved 7 candidates to run for the country's presidential vote set to be held on June 18th. In our special program on the upcoming election, we've reviewed the hopefuls' profiles. Let's have a look.
Welcome to special coverage of Iran's 2021 presidential election. Thank you for joining us. In the next few minutes, I'm going to review the latest developments, I'm going to talk to a guest, and I'm going to go over the history of presidential elections in Iran. So without further ado, let's get started. Iran's Constitutional Council has announced the final list of candidates qualified for the next month's presidential election. 7 people have been approved by the council to run for the top executive post. We're going to take a brief look at a profile of the candidates. Ebrahim Raisi has been the judiciary chief of Iran since 2019. He is also an incumbent member of the Assembly of Experts. Raisi has pledged to form a justice-based administration. He says if elected president, he would fight corruption and tackle economic problems, including poverty and unemployment. Another presidential candidate is Abdul Nasser Himmati. He is an economist who currently serves as the governor of the Central Bank of Iran. Himmati took that post in 2018. Previously, he was the vice president of the Islamic Republic of Iran Broadcasting. He was also the head of the Central Insurance of Iran, the agency in charge of regulating the country's insurance industry. Next, we are going to take a look at the profile of Saeed Jalili, a principalist politician who served as the Secretary of the Supreme National Security Council from 2007 to 2013. In that capacity, Jalili served as Iran's top negotiator in talks with world powers on the country's nuclear program. Jalili also ran for president in 2013 when he received over 4 million votes and ranked third. Next, we are going to talk about Alireza Zakani. He is an Iranian conservative politician. He is a veteran of the Iran-Iraq War in the 1980s. Zakani was a member of parliament from 2004 until 2020 and currently heads the research center of the legislative body. Zakani registered for presidential elections in 2013 and 2017 but was not approved by the Constitutional Council. Next is Mohsen Rezaei. He currently serves as the Secretary of Iran's Expediency Council. He was the chief commander of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps from 1980 until 1997. Rezaei is critical of policies of the previous administrations and believes a new path is needed to resolve Iran's economic problems. Next, Mohsen Mehralizadeh. He is a reformist politician and former governor of Isfahan province. He served as a vice president and the head of the National Sports Organization of Iran under President Mohammad Khatami. The last candidate is Amir Hossein Ghazizadeh Hashemi, a principalist who represents Mashhad and Kalat in parliament. He has been serving in that post since 2008. Last year, he was elected as the first deputy parliament speaker. We are now joined by journalist and political analyst, Mr. Mustafa Khoshish. Hi, sir. Thank you for joining us. I appreciate your time.
First, I want you to let us know what
you think about the final shortlist of candidates who got qualified to run for president this year.
Well, it's good to see that both major camps have their representatives running for the race, at least. least two from the reformists, and of course from the principalists we have some more. But the point here is that when you discuss Iranian politics, it's not so simple to have two major camps. Each of these camps, you know, it's made of so many ranges of ideas. We have political aisles, and mostly they have their representatives in this election. From the principalists that are called revolutionaries, to the milder principalists, or they're called the more logical camp, represented by people like Hassan Rouhani, or people from the moderate camp like Hassan Rouhani, as well as the reformists. They are all present in there, and it's good to see that people can see themselves somehow through these representatives.
Exactly. Now, what about those who got disqualified to run for president this term?
Yeah, this is very important, because when it comes to the Guardian Council, the vetting body that judges the cases of these nominees and the ones that have registered to run for the presidential race or the parliamentary race, the experts assembly race, there is somehow some kind of confusion about the how the council judges the cases. First of all, it's not just about loyalty to the Islamic Revolution or their leader. They measure each candidate against a number of yardsticks or standards and you know, values. Like, they check their background, educational background, job background, to see if they've done any high-level managerial posts, and also they check their skills, they check their sanity, their all their record of life, to see if they are fit enough to, you know, run this post and to run the country. But there is a major difference between judging the cases for a parliamentary election and a presidential election. When they discuss and judge nominees for the parliamentary elections, they might qualify or disqualify, I mean, the candidates. And if the decision of the Guardian Council is that this candidate is disqualified, then the council is duty-bound to let that specific candidate, that given candidate, know why, what has been the reason that he's been rejected and has not been, distinguished as a qualified candidate. But when we go to the presidential race, like what we are going, you know, to see these days, the Guardian Council never disqualifies anyone. I mean, all the candidates are measured against a number of values to see if they are fit enough, and then somehow they are measured against each other to see who has a higher levels and who are really low and are not, you know, for this race. But there is a minimum, and then the ones who have an established case of qualifications, they are the final candidates. So no one is disapproved. Maybe some of the candidates are qualified, but their case has not been established at the Guardian Council. And then there are 12 people, I mean, the jurists in there, there are lawyers in there, and legal experts, 12 of them, and they vote to see if this specific person has an established case of qualifications or not.
So, personally, overall, do you see the final shortlist a fair one?
Well, you could see that from different angles. Some might say yes, because as I said earlier, both major camps have their representatives. Mm-hmm. Some might, you know, there's always been grievances with regard to, you know, the result of this stage of election. I remember quite well, 8 years ago, when the when the list of candidates that have qualified appeared in media, there was a shock, because former President Hashemi Rafsanjani had disqualified because of his age, of course. That's law. And what the Guardian Council does is not measuring, you know, based on subjective judgment. It's objective against, you know, rules and regulations. It's interesting to note that according to the late President Hashemi Rafsanjani, he said, after he disqualified, he represented his loyal aide, Hassan Rouhani. In the words of Hashemi Rafsanjani, Rouhani then had no more than 3% of public support. But after Hashemi Rafsanjani was out, then he, you know, threw his weight behind Hassan Rouhani, and he won 2 presidential races and elections. So that's the case, you know. No one knows who is going to be the winner, actually, because in Iran, when we are talking about presidential elections, everything ends when the election hours, the final hour, ends, because some of our elections, they had their fates, you know, changed on the day of the election.
Thank you so much for your time, and appreciate your contribution to the program. Now, moving on, Iranians will go to the polls on June the 18th to choose a successor to incumbent President Hassan Rouhani. This is the country's 13th presidential election since the victory of the Islamic Revolution in 1979. Let's take a look back at a brief history of some of the previous elections, the voter turnouts, and the candidates who ran for the country's top executive post. Until next time, take care and stay safe.
Well, that's a wrap for now.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
The limelight.
The COVID-19 Bereaved Families for Justice UK campaign, many of whose members lost a loved one to nosocomial COVID, said the coronavirus disease spread in hospitals because they were poorly prepared for the pandemic. It urged ministers to act before a third wave of the virus, driven by the highly transmissible India variant that is taking hold across Britain, causes fresh havoc. We're prepared for you an article written jointly by Dennis Campbell and Anna Bowden. The piece is titled up to 8,700 patients died after catching COVID in English hospitals. The article has been taken from the British newspaper The Guardian. According to official UK National Health Service data obtained by The Guardian, up to 8,700 patients died after catching COVID-19 while in hospital, being treated for another medical problem. The figures, which were provided by the hospitals themselves, were described as horrifying by relatives of those who have died. Jeremy Hunt, the former health secretary, said that hospital-acquired COVID remains one of the silent scandals of this pandemic, causing many thousands of avoidable deaths. NHS leaders and senior doctors have long claimed hospitals have struggled to stop COVID spreading because of shortages of single rooms. NHS leaders and senior doctors have long claimed hospitals have struggled to stop COVID spreading because of shortages of single rooms, a lack of personal protective equipment, and an inability to test staff and patients early on in the pandemic. Now, official figures supplied by the National Health Service Trust in England show that 32,307 people have probably or definitely contracted the disease while in hospital since March of 2020, and 8,747 of them have died. That means that almost 3 in 10, or 27.1% of those infected that way, lost their lives within 28 days. Former Health Secretary Jeremy Hunt, who chairs the Commons Health and Social Care Select Committee, said, "These new figures are devastating and pose challenging questions on whether the right hospital infection controls were in place." The Guardian obtained the data under Freedom of Information laws from 81 of England's 126 acute hospital trusts. The responses show that every trust had to grapple with what doctors call nosocomial or hospital-acquired infection. Many hospitals were unable to keep COVID-positive patients separate from those without the disease, which led to its lethal transmission. According to the Freedom of Information responses, University Hospital Birmingham Trust had the highest number of deaths at 408, followed by Nottingham University Hospital with 279 deaths, and Frimley Health with 259. Nine NHS trusts had 200 or more deaths. However, the number of deaths are influenced by factors such as hospital size, number of single rooms and capacity of its intensive care unit, and the makeup of its local population and level of infection among them, as well as weaknesses in infection control procedures. At a handful of NHS trusts, about a third of all people who died after catching COVID had become infected in hospital. They include Royal Cornwall Hospital, 36%, Salisbury Hospital, 35.2%, and Kettering General Hospital at 31.2%. The answers provided to The Guardian reveal that 8,747 who died were all in hospital for another reason, such as treatment for a fall, flare-up of a serious illness, or to have an operation. The figures include people who died in hospital after discharge. They do not distinguish between those who died of COVID, with COVID, or of another condition potentially exacerbated by the coronavirus, such as a heart attack. While NHS England has published data on hospital-acquired COVID infections since last August, it has not released any statistics on how many people died as a result. The figures provide the most detailed and comprehensive insight yet into how widespread a scourge nosocomial COVID has been over the last 15 months and the huge death toll it has exacted. 45 NHS trusts refused to disclose their death figures, despite their legal obligation to do so under the Freedom of Information Act. COVID-19 Bereaved Families for Justice UK campaign, many of whose members lost a loved one to nosocomial COVID, said the disease spread in hospitals because they were poorly prepared for the pandemic. It urged ministers to act before a third wave of the coronavirus, driven by the highly transmissible India variant that is taking hold across Britain, causes fresh havoc. Matt Fowler, the group's co-chair and co-founder, said, "The mortality rate for patients and staff who were infected in hospitals is horrifying and must be stopped from happening again ahead of a potential third wave of the coronavirus." Matt Fowler added, "One issue, such as segregating patients on wards, personal protective equipment for frontline workers, and testing patients who are discharged, there are critical questions around how prepared hospitals were and the resources they were provided. NHS trusts are required to monitor how many people caught COVID-19 in their hospitals. If someone tests positive between 8 and 14 days into their stay, their COVID is deemed to be probable hospital acquired. Any inpatient's positive test result 15 days or more after admission to hospital is deemed a definite case of nosocomial infection." The NHS trusts with the highest numbers of probable and definite nosocomial infections were university hospitals in Birmingham, with 1,463 cases, Liverpool University Hospitals with 1,160 cases, and Manchester University Hospitals with 1,081 cases. Their size and high levels of COVID in their catchment areas are likely to be key factors. The trust at which the highest proportion of patients died after catching COVID-19 in hospital was Wrightington, Wigan and Lee Trust in Lancashire. It only provided figures for October of 2020 to March of 2021. In that time, 273 patients became infected while in hospital, of whom 174 died, a mortality rate of 63.7%. The NHS Trust, with the next highest percentages by that measure, were Gateshead Health with 55.6% and Wirral University Teaching Hospital with 53.5%. Matt Fowler, the co-founder of COVID-19 Bereaved Families for Justice UK campaign, said Prime Minister Boris Johnson should bring forward the public inquiry he has promised from 2022 to this summer, so it will produce by the autumn an interim report that includes best practices on preventing transmission within hospitals. Matt Fowler added, "Not doing so puts more lives at risk." Dr. Claudia Paoloni, president of the Hospital Consultants and Specialists Association, said the death toll was a human tragedy from which lessons must be learnt. She lambasted government foot-dragging, such as delaying the wearing of face masks in hospitals becoming mandatory and its mishandling of how much mixing people could do over Christmas. Dr. Claudia Paoloni said, "Those led infections in the community to spiral out of control, which combined with inadequate testing and lack of space in hospitals to segregate patients, boosted nosocomial spread. Dr. Paoloni said these unforgivable failings overwhelmed some hospitals and tragically, patients, including NHS staff, who could have been alive today, are instead lost, leaving behind a legacy of mourning families and devastated lives. Chris Hobson, chief executive of hospitals group NHS providers, said nosocomial COVID had infected hospitals worldwide and stressed NHS Trust's determined efforts to keep it in check. Chris Hobson said these figures are distressing and lay bare how difficult the past 15 months have been. Every COVID-19 death has been a tragedy, and Trust leaders' first thoughts are with the families of all those who have died from COVID-19, whatever the original source of the infection. Chris Hobson added, Trust, NHS Trust have worked incredibly hard to maintain a safe environment, but COVID-19 brought unique challenges to every health system in the world. These include significant numbers of patients having COVID-19 without showing symptoms, and early on in the pandemic, insufficient access to rapid turnaround testing. An NHS spokesperson said, the Office for National Statistics and other data conclusively demonstrate that the root cause of rising infection rates in hospitals is rising rates in the community. And throughout the pandemic, weekly reports from Public Health England have consistently shown that outbreaks in hospitals are less common than in other settings. The spokesperson for the NHS added, hospitals' robust infection control measures, including treating COVID and non-COVID patients in separate areas and testing all inpatients on admission and twice in their first week in the hospital.
The debate.
Hello and welcome to Debate. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, targeting civilians, attacking the infrastructure, killing children, killing journalists, destroying media centers, and destroying residential units were all done by Israelis against Palestinians in the Gaza Strip during its latest onslaught. And in the occupied territories, the Israeli regime has continued to steal the land of Palestinians and attack the Al-Aqsa Mosque during the month of Ramadan and beyond. What does it take for the international community to condemn and punish the Israeli regime, and how much more do Palestinians have to suffer before that regime is stopped? Stay with us as we take a look at this month's debate. I'm going to start it off in Gaza City and talk to correspondent Ashraf Shannon. Ashraf, thanks so much for being with us. Well, Ashraf, tell us right now the overall situation. I mean, I've been looking at as far as the losses and the number of buildings and destruction. Just fill us in on the assessment.
Yes, Marzia, right now the human situation is only getting worse as more bodies are found under the rubble. The officials in Gaza realizing how much damage that has been sustained. All of that has not been cleared yet. All the numbers that are coming out by some satellite stations or figures by the UN are not the real figures. You have to understand, it's not only about money. You have to understand also that the loss, it's not only the physical like a loss of people, the loss of memory, the loss of everything dear to people here who've been displaced over and over again by the Israeli regime. Wanton killing and maiming of women, children, and elderly people took place under the watchful eye of the international community. It's about time that the world rises up and stand up for the rights of the Palestinians, the people who have been oppressed by the Israeli regime for decades, Marzieh.
Any hope from Gaza that actually the Israelis will be held responsible committing these crimes against humanity, basically going against the Geneva Convention? Any hope this time around that that will happen?
Well, Palestinians here, they always hear about the international community, about the International Criminal Court, the Rome Statute, but they need concrete things, real things happening. They want Israel to be held accountable. They want Israeli leaders who sent those pilots to bomb their homes to held accountable. And until that is done, there's nothing can help the Palestinians here.
Thank you so much for that update. Ashraf Shannon, correspondent on the ground there in Gaza City. I'd like to welcome my guests to this debate. Zakaria Odeh, coordinator of the Civil Coalition for Palestinian Rights, Al-Quds, and Ted Schmidt, former editor, Catholic New Times out of Toronto. Thank you both for being with us. I'm going to start it off with Zakaria. Now, since 1948, there have been crimes taking place in Palestine that, according to international law, could be considered as war crimes. And if you agree with that, why, after 73 years, is the international community impotent in stopping the Israeli regime in committing crimes against the Palestinian people?
Thank you. Good evening. Thank you. Yes. In fact, for the last 73 years of Israeli occupation since al-Nakba, you know, we talk about the Nakba of the Palestinians. It took place in 1948, but it has been going on every day through the various Israeli policies. I mean, Israel have been for these years implementing a policy of forced displacement, where they have been taking over land, building settlements, expanding illegal settlements, Israeli discriminatory urban planning system, restriction on building for the Palestinian Arabs in Palestine as a whole and in Jerusalem in specific. Demolition of homes, because of the restriction on obtaining building permits. So Palestinians, they built without a permit because the Israeli institution, they don't provide the Palestinians with a permit to build houses. And if you build without a permit, then the houses will be demolished. So it's very important to mention that there are nearly 22,000 homes that are built in Jerusalem without a permit. What does that mean? That these homes are under the threat of demolition. So, as well, the closure of Jerusalem, the restriction of access and movement for the Palestinians from the West Bank and Gaza to access the city of Jerusalem. You know, Jerusalem is one of the main holy cities for both Christian and Muslim.
Let me just jump in here, Zakaria, because what I understand is that today you were in the middle of some attacks. Can you tell us what happened today in Jerusalem Al-Quds that you witnessed?
Yeah, you know that. I mean, there have been a continuous and systematic harassment by the police in various neighborhoods of Jerusalem. As you know, one of the main neighborhoods, I think you are aware of, Sheikh Jarrah, it's a neighborhood which has been since 1956. These were Palestinian refugees who were forced to leave their country as a result of the Nakba. And now there is an Israeli decision to evict and to force displace. We are talking about 73 families, nearly 500 people that the Israeli court has took a decision to evict them from their home and to replace them with Israeli settlers. You know, the blessing, I mean, in settling settlers in the occupied territories is a clear violation of Geneva Convention. It's a war crime according to Rome statute. It's not only that, that what has been going on for the last week, that the Israeli settlers have been storming Al-Aqsa Mosque. Every day they have been entering Al-Aqsa Mosque, which is the main holy places, one of the main holy places for the Muslim. So they enter the mosque, they do Talmudic or Israeli religious pray in the mosque, while they have been preventing the Palestinians from the rest of the West Bank and Gaza to access to the city of Jerusalem.
All right, stay with me, Zachariah. Let me get Ted in on this debate now. Ted, according to the Geneva Convention, war crimes are defined as these. I'm going to read the top four. Willful killing, torture or inhumane treatment, willfully causing great suffering or serious injury to body or health, extensive destruction of property. Now, none of these would be hard to prove when it comes to Israeli crimes. Just a video of the regime destroying buildings and killing whole families would be sufficient. So what will it take for the international community to make that transition and actually start holding Israel responsible for war crimes?
Well, it is happening. I'll start with quoting one of the great Israeli Americans, Jeff Helper, who's been living in Israel for 40 years. He asked the question that many of us are asking, how do they get away with it? For generations, they've been ignoring the Geneva Conventions. They've been ignoring international law. But Marcia, let me just remind you what the big change is. In 1967, the Six-Day War, there were only three American networks. What has changed the whole equation here is the extraordinary proliferation of the internet and social media. Mm-hmm. The great researcher Norman Finkelstein, in his in one of his books, made the point: this time you've gone too far. And around 2008, people began to totally get the picture that they weren't getting the picture. And now with social media, people are beginning to understand for the first time. Sadly, it takes a massacre, another massacre, and I would say another one, starting in 2008, 2014, 2018 at the Gaza Wall, where 2,000 to 3,000 people are killed with nothing sent to Israelis. So my point is that we in North America live in the culture of Disneyland. It's hard to keep track of things. There's so many diversions. But now it's even on the front page of the New York Times, a very good article. I never thought I'd see it. So social justice takes a long time. I've been at this for much of my adult life, and I know things move slowly, but now they're catching up. People around the world, you'll see international demonstrations, and I'm relatively hopeful now that people begin to see exactly what's been going on. Zechariah has pointed out exactly what's happening on a day-to-day basis to Palestinians. Most North Americans do not see this, and so they're finally starting to see. And so that's a big point for me, is that we're finally even getting the New York Times to print decent articles in a Toronto paper. We're beginning to get some balanced coverage.
And Ted, I just want to stay with you for a minute, because you talked about most North Americans not getting the main story. And with that, we look at the situation when it is talked about, it's for Palestinians. Rarely in these Western stations do they talk about the Christian Palestinians, that Christian Palestinians exist. Jewish Palestinians exist, as a matter of fact. Why do you think that is never talked about? We saw Christians being attacked for Easter of this year by the Israeli regime forces, but you never see that really talked about in Western mainstream media.
Well, there's a lot of things they don't talk about in Western media. One of the sad things, because I've been to Israel-Palestine three times, is so many Christians have left. They're among the best educated people, and they've just lost so much hope. They can't wait to get out. They are very much a minority in a Muslim area. And so, you know, there's not much media coverage of that. You're exactly right. So I can't answer to that, but that's exactly true.
Isn't it odd that the countries that claim that they are Christian-based, that even for them, because they happen to be Palestinian Christians, then they choose to even ignore the Christians, not only in Palestine, but we can see throughout this region. Don't you find that odd in general?
Yes, I do. But the great Palestinian writer who worked in America most of his life, Edward Said, his great book, Orientalism, there's been a bias here in the West about anything to do with the Muslim world. But that's changed. In 1948, when Palestinians were dispossessed of their land and they lived in camps, now they're among the most educated people in the Arab world, and they hold important positions at American universities. It's extraordinary. My own city here is one of the most diverse cities in the world, and when I was a kid growing up, I grew up in a Jewish neighborhood. I never knew anything about Islam. I never knew any Muslims. But the extraordinary change has been these voices are beginning to be heard.
Okay, great. Say with me, Ted. Let me cross back over with Zachariah. Zachariah, now we have at least 65 Palestinian kids that were killed in this latest Israeli onslaught on the Gaza Strip. I mean, are the lives of Palestinian children important for the international community or not? And we should be hearing and seeing such outrage as what has taken place these 11 days, especially the death of this many children.
Unfortunately, the international community double standard when they deal with the issues. So when it comes to the Palestinians, we feel that our lives and our children's life is not really that important, because I think, you know, this war against Gaza has been going on every few years. They go the same way and they destroy the buildings, they destroy the infrastructure, they kill people, they kill children. I think Israel is doing that because they have this impunity. I think it's time to stop the Israeli impunity and to take action. I think Israel will not continue to commit all these crimes and all these atrocities against the Palestinian people, whether in Gaza or the West Bank, and especially in Jerusalem, without the support or without the closing eye by the international community. Mm-hmm. So that's what we try always to talk to the international community. I think it's time that you should act. You should put pressure to stop this Israeli ongoing crimes and policies and atrocities.
And Zachariah, I'm so sorry because I'm short of time, but do you think with this, we're looking at the so-called international community, that it just proves that resistance is the only way? Your take on that?
Yeah, of course, because now we have been hearing, I think, now, for example, after the last war on Gaza, the last clashes, we have been hearing that the European Union, they are talking about there are other elements or actors in the occupied territories, which they meant in Gaza, like Hamas, that we need to talk to. We can't ignore. We need to consider. So unless people die, unless there is destruction, unless blood is really going down, so the international community will not move and will not do. And even in spite of all what's going, in spite of all these losses by the Palestinians, with their children, lives, destruction, still some European countries are blaming the Palestinians, and still they're saying that Israel has the right to defend themselves. Mm-hmm. We as a Palestinian, we don't have the right. We have no right. Our life is not really important, is not really matter. And it's important to say that all this escalation during the last few years of Israeli crimes and Israeli violation and atrocities has been taking place with the full support of the Trump American administration.
Okay.
You know, he was partner with the Israelis in all these colonization, apartheid, and crimes that are being committed against the Palestinian people.
All right. Well, Ted, what about that? I mean, it appears that Palestinians can't count on international law, international bodies to do anything. But what about the international civil society? We witness many, many protests around the world condemning Israel. Do you think that these actions or pressure can continue and that the civil society in the world can actually make this change and put pressure on Israel, like what we saw against apartheid South Africa?
I think
the big player in this whole equation is the United States. Change will not happen within Israel, Palestine. And the good news for me is that young Jews are understanding this, and they're saying, not in my name. American Jews are, many of the young people are having a transformation. They look on the screen and they say, this is not what Judaism is. They're moving away from Zionism, which is a false creed, and many are seeing it. And now you have wonderful people like Peter Beinart saying, I'm out. Zionism is not my Judaism. And so it's these very important, very well-educated young Jews who are in the streets. They're saying, not in my name. And I'm very, very hopeful that a change is afoot. It's not going to be the same thing, but it's going to happen in America. Slow but sure.
And Zachary, your thoughts and your perspective, what is it going to take for Palestinians to attain victory and total liberation? We've seen actually something interesting with the Palestinians being in solidarity, whether it's the occupied territories this time around or Gaza Strip. Yes. Your take.
Yeah, I think what's happened during the last few days, it never happened before. You know, it united the Palestinian people everywhere in the West Bank, in Gaza, under the so-called the Green Line or 48, in the diaspora, in the camps, in the Arab countries, in Europe, everywhere. So what happened, the Israeli aggression during the last 2 weeks has been uniting the geography and the people as well. So I think that the solidarity and the support, whether in the Arab area or in internationally, we have been witnessing an increase of the solidarity and the support by the international community, the people. I think what's after this war and this uprising in the old part of Palestine is not the same as it was before. I think this gave a message to everybody, to the Israelis, to the Americans, to the international community, which says that people will not subject to all these colonial settler apartheid regime. They are rejecting the American policy here and the American support to the Israeli governments in the occupied territories and in Palestine. I think we have a hope that things will change. There is a change, and in addition to what our friend he talked about, there has been changes within even the Jewish community, the young generation in the U.S., in Europe, everywhere. So this gives us a good hope that there will be a good opportunity for a change for this situation.
And on that note, I'd like to thank both of you for being with us on this debate at Press TV. Zachariah Odeh, coordinator of the Civil Coalition for Palestinian Rights out of Al-Quds, and Ted Schmidt, a former editor, Catholic at New Times, out of Toronto. Thank you both. And always, we appreciate you being with us on another debate. I'm Marzia Hashimi, signing out right here from our international studios in Tehran. Thank you and goodbye.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us.
The keys of life.
Axel Jawadi talks about the various keys of life and has brought about this book to be a companion for the very famous Mafatih al-Jinan, where one is a tool or the keys for paradise, and this book, of course, are the keys of life.
The Keys of Life, a program designed to tell you that what Islam gives you will help get you home with joy and faithfulness. So, well, listen to
The Keys of Life.
The world is a very, very big house, many people living in many rooms. We must open all the doors up, we must unlock them all today. Throw all
the keys away. من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. My name is Sheikh Zaid Al Salami. A few years ago, I started the course of wanting to commentate on a very important book that I believe is something that would be useful for everyone who reads it. And that is the book Mafatih al-Hayat, written by Ayatollah al-Uzma al-Sheikh Jawadi Amuli. We've spoken about marriage a few times before, and here when we're talking about relationships with your kin, with your family members, obviously you are going to have to deal with the topic of your spouse. The first part of this discussion is on how you are able to deal with your wife, and the second part is how to deal with your husband. But look at the riwayat from Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam that speak about how much we need to serve our parents, serve our husband, serve our wife, serve our brothers and fellow brothers and sisters, serve